Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show, a place where business and thought leaders come to weigh in on important sales-related topics that you can use in your sales career and life. I'm your host, Jason Cutter. My mission is to get your help in changing sales from something prospects fear to an act of service they actually seek out and appreciate. Whether you're in sales, leading sales teams, or own a business, I hope this helps you improve your selling effectiveness and you can go out into the world as an authentic persuader. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Happy Thursday, January 21st. So glad that you're here watching this live, whether you're on LinkedIn or Facebook or YouTube, as well as maybe catching this on the replay or on the podcast. Welcome. Super excited. Obviously, there's a lot going on. We are a few weeks into 2021, which is crazy to think about how fast things seem to be going. I mean, it just seems like a wild couple of weeks. I'm super excited for today. And I know I say that every time. I say that every time on the podcast because I'm always just excited. I love chatting with people, especially people in the industry that are doing different things. I just think it's so fun. So I have with me today, and I'm about to bring her on. So her name is Maya Connett, and she was a guest on my podcast last year. She works for a company called Clary, and she is an enterprise revenue director. And one of the big things that I enjoyed about the conversation I had with her last time, and part of the reason why I wanted to have her come back, is that she is one of those people building bridges between silos, right? So normally there's this sales versus marketing, this kind of division. And so I love anybody who's bringing those teams together and wants to see that difference. And then also people who are doing things in a way that helps sellers relationally, not just transactionally. So I think that's great. And there's some big things that have been happening recently for her, which made her 2020 definitely a fascinating year. So I am going to bring her in. Please welcome Maya. Maya, welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Live Show.
Thank you so much. Thrilled to be here. Quite a busy couple weeks.
Yes. So let's just talk about it because I think it's super fun. You know, catch up the people. Let's talk about personal and then fading into business. What was some highlights from your 2020 and or, you know, how has your 2021 been so far?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had a baby girl in Q4 of 2020, our first child. And so with that comes all these new challenges and raising a new child in the pandemic. So it's been quite a ride, but also just really appreciate all the kind of forced time at home to build our little family and appreciate actually, you know, not traveling for business right now. I think any other year it would have been very different. So that's been amazing. And both of my 90-year-old grandmas got the vaccine recently. So that's positive news. Nice. Yeah, just really excited to also raise our daughter in a world where a woman can be the vice president. So very exciting. Yeah. Today and yesterday.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's so funny how, you know, when I talk to someone who's focused on enterprise B2B sales, how you said, you know, you had your daughter in Q4, not in December, not in November, but like you're back in it. Maya is back in the mode. One thing you told me before we, you know, jumped on here was that you came back on purpose, knowing that you were hitting the last few weeks of the fiscal year to just get some results. And how has that been? How has that been going? You know, these last few weeks.
The start of this fiscal year back in early March, you know, was really tough and everything just with all the uncertainty. But this second half of the year has definitely been more, there's just more hope across the board. And I think people are starting to spend and realize that, you know, digital transformation needs to be a priority, regardless of kind of what's happening in the business. And to achieve some of these aggressive growth goals, you have to invest. So it's been good. And I think there's some topics that we're going to touch on here that are why it's necessary for us to really understand what virtual sellers are doing in this world is super important right now.
That's great. I'm looking forward to it. And for anybody watching this, listening, make sure to put a comment, a chat, say hello. If you have a question, something specific, we're going to talk about all manner of diversity, women, especially in sales, to enterprise sales strategies, marketing. So if you have any questions along those lines, make sure to put those in the chat so that we can talk about those. So one of the themes, and this is where I thought it would be fun to start with, from our conversation before, was about diversity, and not just diversity, you know, that you might think of, but diversity, specifically women in sales, which you're in the Bay Area, as am I, near the Bay Area, and you're in tech sales, SaaS, B2B enterprise, and in the definite minority in that space for sales. And so, you know, what would be great is to hear from you. You know, not necessarily just the journey and the struggles, because I know we covered that before, but what do you see as like promising changes? What are the ways that organizations can help support that? You know, there's so many different topics, especially as I've been diving in to as being a board member on Girls Who Sell, which is looking at helping women early on realize sales can be an intentional choice, right? Like something you can actually pick to do as a career. And so what are you seeing? What is giving you hope? And then what still needs to be done?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'll start with the first piece, which you mentioned, is telling people that this can be a career. I mean, I think a lot of, in college, I never considered sales, right? I loved people and communications, and but at the end of the day, I didn't know any female salespeople. I definitely didn't know any female salespeople in tech. And the tech salespeople I did know were pretty old school, right? They were IBM reps from back in the day. And so I think, to be honest, it all starts with that perception and seeing that it's possible. I love John Barrows, who has this great book he wrote with his daughter about, you know, I can be in sales when I grow up. And it's written from a little girl's perspective of hosting, doing a cookie sale. And so, like, we need to teach the next generation that this is 100%, you know, not only a very exciting career, but also that it's, you know, you can get to be a sales leader. I think the problem is there's not a lot of female CROs still. And so because of that, there's not a lot of folks to kind of teach the way, but hopefully my generation is the one to get to those levels and ensure that we're teaching little girls that's, you know, this is a career path that is lucrative, is exciting. It plays on a lot of the strengths of relationship building and just really ensuring that, yeah, the future is bright and sales is an amazing career. I mean, I joke that, you know, there's nothing else I'd rather do. It's I get to talk to new people all the time and really be collaborative, which is something I love.
So let's talk about the relationship piece and the relational piece and that sales piece, which it still sticks in my head from when we chatted for the podcast last year. Which you have a bunch of stats, you know, this might be a good time to put out there, you know, as far as, you know, women in revenue, women in sales, you know, either percentage or their success. But really what I am most interested in is why do women have like the ability to be effective in sales? Like, what is it that if they're, again, I always preface this with if they know how to sell, right? Not just be an order taker, because there's a lot of nice order taking women in sales, but they're not very effective because they're just order taking versus, you know, having persuasion skills and actually making a career out of it. But what do they bring to the table that's effective for them? And that then, let's say the men listening, the men in sales can take that and go, okay, that would work too if I shifted it, right? So that, you know, things to take from the toolbox that women might naturally have that could work well.
What the biggest one to me is just listening, being a really, really good listener. The best salespeople I know, they do very little talking. And I was on a call, I guess it was earlier this week, and I talked for maybe 10% of the time, and the prospect talked for 90%. And I got off the call and I was like, that was an amazing call, because it was a male. He opened up, he shared, I kept us on track, but otherwise I literally just listened. And so what this means is I have a wealth of data now to be able to build a really compelling, collaborative, consultative, mutual success plan for us to achieve a partnership, right? So at the end of the day, like, that is number one. And I was told that a long time ago, like, if your discovery calls can be, 90% or more of the prospect talking, you're more likely to close the deal. Another thing I think is just the kind of nurturing aspect that's really needed, especially in enterprise sales and these really long sales cycles. You have to be engaged with the people as people first and as employees second. So I do a really good job of remembering to, remember their favorite wine or when their wife's due with the baby and, some of the challenges she's had along the way. Or their favorite beer, so that, once we do get to celebrate, I can send it their way. So I think a lot of like the human first elements are really key, to lead with. And then secondarily, it's like, how do we, on paper get to achieve a partnership? But people buy from people they like. And at the end of the day, people like people who are listen to them as well. So.
I love that. And I just shared Anthony Weber's comment, and he said that active listening and relative questions are key to hitting and exceeding goals. And I think that's so important. And it's interesting how much of a radical, I'm using air quotes, shift that is from what most people think they need to do in sales and how they think sales operates, which is monologuing and explaining and features and benefits and talking and monopolizing the conversation and just brute force. Versus what you're talking about. And one thing that really strikes me that I love that you said is that, remember that they're people first and then employees second. I've never heard it put that way, which is fantastic, because I think that's the key is, yes, it's an enterprise sale. Yes, you're dealing with stakeholders. Yes, that person might be, I don't know, VP of marketing. Let's say that's your target. But at the end of the day, they're still a person and they have their fears, their issues, their concerns. They have the ability to buy from you if they like you. If they don't like you, it's going to be hard. So I love that.
I think right now too, like, people's, home lives and work lives are, my office is in my bedroom. Like, they're so combined that it's even more crucial now, since the start of the pandemic. So I also think one of the people first element is, I would consider success if one of the people I'm working with gets promoted throughout the life cycle of our deal, or they, look to me for a reference thereafter. I try to like leave LinkedIn reviews, recommendations. I think that's really exciting when you can help someone you're working with advance their career, outside of the deal you're working, right? Just helping them highlight their best skill sets, ensuring that you're illuminating them to their leadership team and what they've brought to the table. I think a lot of that is really special. And I the best salespeople I've seen do a really good job of promoting the people that they work with and kind of giving them a new platform too.
But Maya, what happens if they get promoted and they don't buy from you, or you spent all this time and energy and then they leave the company and go somewhere else?
That just happened to me, actually. So it happens, more than you'd like. But at the same time, to me, it's a good thing. Like, they will remember you if you treated them human first. And if you, if you did kind of your collaborative selling job, then they will know that when their new company is ready, they'll bring you in and ensure you can work together again. So I think another thing is key too, is like not losing that gap. So I make it a point to keep that nurturing communication up in the interim, because I know how important that is just from a relationship standpoint.
And of course, I knew what you were going to say on that. I mean, one of the big things you pointed out last time we spoke was how it's really the relationship long game is what you're playing without the need for the transaction, because there's a lot of mobility, especially in what you're selling, who you're focusing on, especially if you're, you know, doing anything around the Bay Area, there's a lot of mobility. And so they might not buy from you now. They're going to go to another company. They're going to remember you. If they have a need for it, then they're going to look you up, right? Or you're going to look them up. And I think that's such an important lesson, to play that long game instead of, oh, well, they got promoted or they're going to change companies, so I'm going to move on to the next one and I'm just going to drop them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's consistency is key. It's, you know, treating them like, you know, they are your network. And even though you've, you know, tried to sell to them before, it's still like, your professional image, their professional image, all kind of on the table. So the more you can keep it consistent and just ensure there's kind of no break to that relationship, the better.
At what point though, because I'm thinking in my head, like I'm going to follow this person, I'm going to put stuff on LinkedIn, they go to their new company, maybe send them a note, congratulations on this. How much of that is purely relational, no strings attached? How much of that is still relational, tactical? Like, there's no strings attached. I'm sending you a note, but I'm sending you a note because I want you to buy from me. Like, at some point, where do you play that out in your head or with your teams?
Yeah, so I actually don't think I play it out that way in my head. I literally am always thinking like, oh, cool. This guy, you know, he moved on. He got a bigger, better job. Like, you know, there was, you know, he's been there. He'd been there a while, like needed change, needed challenge, wanted to expand their skill set. So I genuinely like think that is the key, is you don't treat it like, hey, you know, I'm going to hit you up for another contract. You are playing it truly like, cool, you're building your team. Like, let me send some good people your way. You kind of create a community around that and around them at their new company. And many, many times I've had the karma come back my way too. So that's why I think I don't think of it as kind of siloed there, is I've had it where folks come to us because they've used us before, they're at a new company. And they had such a great relationship with their last rep that they, you know, wanted an intro and wanted to kind of revisit things. So.
Makes sense. And I figured that's the case. I mean, I'm just thinking of all the people who promote like cadences, and all I'm thinking in my head is you're like, we're doing relational stuff. I'm touching base with you because I care and I want to build this relationship and give you value. And if I'm giving you value, at some point, something may happen or not, but I'm just going to do it anyway, versus I'm going to put you in my 15-part cadence that also includes sending you a handwritten note that was printed on a computer that looks handwritten. And then it's also going to send you this gift and it's going to do this thing, right?
Well, really good point, actually, that we talked about before, is this is where texting comes into play, because that's something you can't automate, or we're not automating. You could. But it's something that we are finding is crucial in every single deal we do. At the end of the day, there's a lot of clutter on people's calendars. There's a ton of clutter in their inbox, but everyone's at home. Nobody's at an office with an office phone, and they can respond to a super short text. Sometimes people have read receipts on even. but this is something we're tracking in every single one of our deals now, because we know how crucial it is. If you have that kind of just quick ability to ask questions, get answers, check in, but not be like overly pushy, it flows so, so much better than cadences. And to be perfectly honest, I don't use them at all. I have put reminders for myself on my calendar instead, so that it is super personalized and kind of white glove touch points versus a little more mass in that respect. So I'm telling you, texting is the new frontier. It's the old frontier, but it's new. And it's something that it's harder to track, of course. But we actually now have a field that's like texting relationship established with economic buyer. And then I think we want to blow that out to where we write like the depth of that relationship, like touch base a few times a week, or, you know, just open this, you know, texting line of communication.
So just so people understand, you with Clary, you are focused on enterprise level buyers, right? So we're talking long sales cycles, big purchase price relative, you know, of this whole thing. And so what's interesting is to think about that texting relationship with the economic buyer, that person who has the money to buy and is the one, hopefully, maybe decision maker close to that person. But having a texting relationship, which seems to be crossing the line from businessy, I've got to call you, we've got to do meetings, I've got to come to your office to sell you. Now we're talking about texting. One of my concerns with this, because I've seen this, is, and I want to know your side and how you focus on this, is I've seen salespeople who in a B2B space get a texting relationship going with their buyer, right? With their potential buyer, who it's, you know, semi-transactional repeated cycles. And then what happens is it defaults to text and they can never get the person on the phone and they can't get decisions made because it's fallen into this either email or text black hole or spiral. How do you address that, or what do you think about that?
So sometimes I use text to say, hey, when are you free to jump on a call? Right. Or like, just got your email. Happy to elaborate. What's your schedule like for a quick call? So I think you have to just push the call, because I haven't gotten to those situations because I'm always pushing a call or a meeting. And again, like, I think too, like the world's changed. Like before pre-pandemic, texting wasn't as like necessary in these, because again, people were in-person meetings, they could see each other, they like knew they were at their desk or they weren't, like, but that personal blurred line has entered our lives here, personal and professional. And so because of that, you know, I think it's, as long as you have, you know, you have spoken and like not from a first text relationship,
right?
Establish a relationship first to like be invited to be that personal.
How do you set that up? How do you approach that and then ask for that access?
Yeah, so sometimes it's after a really good meeting. We would send an email or even send a quick text like, thanks for your time, a follow-up, you know, follow-ups headed your way, look forward to connecting again next week. So something like really professional, really short and sweet, but just so they have your number. And even sometimes I say, here, you know, I have to introduce myself usually because they don't know who it is, just so you have my number saved. If you need anything, you know where to find me. So you're opening yourself to like, you can get me at all hours. And then they feel kind of more comfortable to say, you know, typically it's, yeah, great, thanks for the time, looking forward to that email. And then once you establish that relationship and have those next meetings set and everything, you can revisit and say, if they send something that you really need to talk through instead of just responding to via email, especially when it comes to things like pricing, right? You can just force that call by saying, hey, I'm free and, you know, free in an hour. What's your calendar look like?
Well, and I appreciate the fact that you're not using text to close the deal. You're not trying to do via text what some people try to do, text or email, which is to close the deal. It's the vehicle to stay in touch and then, you know, push for that. And I think that's the key, right? So it sounds more on this, more on the salesperson side to control the use of text as the vehicle to get on the phone when necessary, than it is like the other, you know, the potential buyer shutting it down. It's more that if you're not getting phone calls with people, it's because as a salesperson, you're not driving that way, right?
Yeah. And it's, to be honest, to make sure the details are T's are dotted, or T's are crossed and I's are dotted, because like you can ask a real simple question and get a yes or no answer when you're kind of working on the contracting and the paperwork side of it. So sometimes it's really saves a lot of time because, you know, we all know people's inboxes, email inboxes are just like inundated these days. And if you just need to ask a simple question, it's way easier.
Yeah, makes sense. So before we got into talking about texting, which is awesome, my friend Tim Skiba, he had said when we were talking about it before, adding value to others' lives is even more rewarding because we are all people first. So I wanted to share that. I appreciate Tim for saying that, and appreciate Tim in general. And, you know, I think that's the key, right? I mean, I think Scott McGregor has this organization and one of their brands and things that they have, and I have a shirt for it, says people over everything, right? And it's people with a line over everything. And then when you remember that, it just makes everything so much easier. And it takes away that handout transactional kind of neediness to, it's just about people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, I mean, again, I'd say the past year has really taught us that you don't know what's going on in people's personal lives. And it, you know, I just got off the phone with somebody who I didn't know they'd had COVID, but they had. And so you just really start to understand health is paramount, right? And so if, you know, you're not being responsive, or, you know, something, you know, your business life isn't as buckled in as it was, maybe something in your personal life is going on. So I think like that is huge to just remember.
So let's talk about this. So building our value engineering, that was one of the things you had said to me. I know that we're focusing on the value. What does that mean to you? Why is this a topic we wanted to chat about today?
Yeah. So especially right now, I'd say where CFOs are tightening the belt more than they ever have in the last maybe, you know, 8 to 10 years. We have to be able to demonstrate cost savings, time savings, across the board. Without doing that, it's really, really difficult for folks to commit to long-term contracts, to, you know, high dollar value contracts, because they, in this kind of uncertain time we're in, it takes a lot of trust. And when you're kind of entering a new logo relationship, as we call it, you know, that trust hasn't fully been established yet. So the more we're always iterating on how can we better sell value related to what they don't have to do anymore, right? So it's how do you make sure that someone doesn't have to work nights and weekends? Like, how do you add time back to their day by creating efficiencies and streamlining processes and not making people have to manually massage data in a spreadsheet? And so that for, I'm constantly thinking about it because the value is so different to different people at different companies. And even within the same operations group, value could be different to different stakeholders. So what is fascinating is time is something we all have the same amount of. And so if you can really tie, you know, whose day will get lighter thanks to X piece of technology, then you can actually have a cohesive story. And they can better understand, kind of that 3-year horizon of what, the amount of time they'll save, from using your technology.
If there's one thing I know, it's that sales is full of failure. Even if you're a Hall of Fame level sales professional, you can make a great income despite losing more than you're winning. If there's one aspect of sales that most people fear and what keeps a lot of people even wanting to get into sales, it's getting hit with objections. That is why I wrote my latest book, The Sales Consultant Guide to Overcoming Objections, Yours and Theirs. This is the first in my new series of short books, guides filled with what you need for helping you improve your selling effectiveness. No fluff, no long-winded stories, no filler to make it seem more valuable, just actual foundation-building strategies to help you become aware of the true nature of why your prospects bring up objections, the different type of objections, and then specific ways to overcome them that are universal to most any sales process, product, service, or style. Go to Amazon.com today and get your copy of A Sales Consultant's Guide to Overcoming Objections. Or if you'd rather, as a gift to the listeners of this podcast, email me at jason@cutterconsultinggroup.com and I'll send you a complimentary full version of it as my thank you for listening and supporting this show. It's so fascinating to me because I see a lot of times companies struggle, salespeople struggle with that ROI component of what they're selling and fully understanding it or being adaptable to different companies, same industry, different sizes, whatever it might be. You know, sometimes it's easy, right? So for me as a consultant, if I help a company close, you know, 20 more sales a year, that's pretty easy. We have a dollar amount. We know what that's worth. What did it cost to get there? What's the ROI percentage on it? It either makes sense or it doesn't, right? Like that's easy. And there's times where you're selling things like what you're focused on, which it's not going to help them do more. It's actually going to or close more, generate more revenue necessarily. It's more about what it's going to save them from. And I love that creativity of trying to sell that.
Yeah, we do both. We do increase conversion rates, but I'm finding that, you know, there's all these so many factors that go into that, right? So like, close, you know, to close more deals, it's not just one thing, but time and literally the absence of having to do something that takes pulling report from Salesforce, massaging the data, sending it to the CRO, ensuring that the CRO likes it. Oh no, he wants different metrics. Let's go revisit. Like, all of that is very measurable and very, very painful too. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we talk about moments that matter a lot. And so these, you know, are moments in a presentation where you want them walking away from that, thinking, feeling, and doing something. And so I always have one that's related to how can we make that person's day less stressful? Like, I'm always thinking in that mindset. And when I'm, you know, presenting our platform, because I think that's so crucial. Like, we're living in this very high stress time, and like, how can we, give people time back in their day to spend with their families? Like, I'm now thinking about that too. Like, hey, let's get you at the door, you know, 20 minutes early so you can spend it with your kids. So.
Yeah, which is, you know, before was something I know that you like that balance and being able to do stuff. Obviously, now it's a, you know, a little closer to home, saving those moments to spend with the new addition to the family for sure. So what did you call it again in the presentation? It was moments of what?
Moments that matter. So this is
moments that
I learned from one of the leaders at my company, and he's been using it for a while now. But the concept is that if you were leaving a meeting and walking to the elevator and the prospect got in the elevator and, ran into, you know, a colleague that they knew, and the colleague asked them, like, what was that meeting you were just in? They would only be able to remember three things, really, like three major pillars. And you want them thinking, feeling, and doing these things after. So that's something we're always talking about. Like, you want them to feel a certain way, think differently, and then take action too, right?
Got it. Moments that matter. And It's so interesting because obviously what I see a lot is salespeople who are going through their standard pitch deck, their conversation, doing their thing, semi-autopilot, desensitized because they're just doing it day in and day out, and then missing those like nuggets they're going to leave that person with that are just going to be longstanding.
And so these moments that matter are customized to every, so sometimes we have different moments that matter for different stakeholders. They're always customized, and We sometimes say them up front at the start of a meeting, and then we ask them to like grade us on how well we did on them at the very end. So a little corny, but at the same time, like I think they appreciate it because we're looping back to the central themes and concepts that we wanted to convey. And sometimes we did a horrible job on one of them, right? Like they didn't think differently, to be perfectly honest. And so then we know that in our follow-up and in our next meeting, we have to really drive that one home. So it's like a, it's again, back to that relational component of we're thinking about these stakeholders as people first, what do they really care about? And it might be, you know, it might be something different than we'd initially thought. And so sometimes those moments change throughout the presentation as well.
So just to clarify, are you saying in the beginning of the presentation, like, here's a moment that matters and you're calling it what it is, and that's like the headline of the slide? Or are you just talking about the topic?
We'll say we start with the end in mind is the way we say it. So if you, we want you to leave the meeting feeling these three ways. And we highlight those at the beginning. And then at the end, we're like, how do we do on these? So
That's brilliant. I mean, a lot of people put it as like, here's my outline. Here's what I'm going to cover. Here's all the things I'm going to talk about and do or ask you about, but not from an even higher level, which is here's the takeaway. Like, here's what we want to leave you with. Here's the end result.
Well, and I think a key difference is also we put it in quotes. Like, we want it to be something they would literally say to somebody in the elevator. So, you know, wow, this would save me so much time, or I need my CEO to see this, or like, so we always put it as words out of their mouth.
Wow. I've never seen that or thought of that before. And that is brilliant because you're basically teeing it up for them. And you're also setting the framework. Like you said, sometimes you've, you know, it hasn't worked, but you're literally saying like, I mean, mentally and verbally, if we do our job, these are the things you will say. Like, I have done those before where I'm like, in my mind, I know when I'm done with this, you're going to run to the decision maker and you're going to go get this done. Like, but not to, in quotes, here's the things you're going to be saying when we're done.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah. I mean, I don't take credit at all for this. This is one of the sales leaders that I've worked for who came up with this concept, but we've seen it work really well. Sometimes it's a little corny, but it's actually like good corny because they, you know, they see it, it takes them out of like standard presentation mode too. It's a little bit of pattern interrupt. We sometimes do it pre-agenda, so they don't even know like what we're going to cover today yet. We just, they know how they're supposed to feel at the end of it.
Which, and again, the agendas, the tools in the toolbox, it doesn't matter. What you want is, I want a new, you know, piece of furniture built. Like, how we're going to get there, I don't really care. It's like, here's what I want. And that's what you're setting it up for. And I think there's a piece there too, where yes, it might be a little corny. It's definitely a pattern interrupt because most everybody is not doing that. And it's also very authentic because that's true. That's what you want. You want them to feel that way. And then what I love about it is at the end is you ask them, how did we do, right? You want the feedback instead of a lot of sellers. They say some things, they want to move forward, but they don't really want the feedback. They don't really want to know the truth of if somebody liked it or if they did a good job or not.
Yeah, no, I think the grading thing, I actually really enjoy just saying like, how do we do on these? We don't do actual grades, but you know, how did we do on these? And usually they say like, oh yeah, these two were great. And this one, like I would need another meeting to better understand that. And so it's like, oh, perfect. Okay. Let's schedule a deep dive to go through, you know? Yeah.
which is way better than how a lot of presentations I see end, you know, in the sales pitch kind of mode, which is, all right, so what did you guys think? And, you know, what should we do next? Where do we take it from here?
So one other thing, that's another little tip that I've implemented in basically all my deals, is we call it a mutual success plan, right? And so we don't ask that at the end. We say, here's what, you know, typical process would look like. What of this looks necessary? What would you add based on your internal processes? And so you're coaching them on how to buy. And in, you know, often these people have bought maybe a couple pieces of technology, but they're not doing this every day, right? We're doing this every day where we're coaching people to evaluate and purchase technology. So that has been super successful because it's collaborative too. It's saying, like, this is a living document where, you know, as we have meetings, we cross them off. We write the types of stakeholders involved. If we have clarifying questions about feature function stuff, we throw it all in there so it doesn't get lost in email. It really becomes this like living, breathing game plan for how you'll achieve a partnership together. And people really like it because they see that you are the project, you're going to project manage this so they don't have to, is another good way to put it.
Which is so important because, like you said, most of the time, the person you're dealing with isn't a professional buyer, procurement person, especially at a certain level, maybe small things, but even then, most are not. And so they don't know what they're doing. And a lot of salespeople, sellers think, okay, well, you're in that position, so you must know what you're doing and you know how this is going to work and who we need to involve and how you get paid, how you get the money so we can pay for this. And most of the time, that is not the case. So I love that framework you're talking about.
The procurement people love it too, because they're like, oh, wow, you've done all of this with my team already. Like, they don't have clarity into that, right? And so it shows all the work previously done, all the stakeholders previously involved, the dates, the lengths of the meetings in some cases I put on there. And that then shows procurement like, oh, wow, we really are at the 11th hour here. There's two more things to check off, you know, or, you know, great, you've already engaged with our legal team before. You know, this will go more smoothly this time around or something.
Yeah. And fundamentally, this all goes under the umbrella of make it as easy as possible for your buyer to buy. If you're talking enterprise with lots of people, I love that because I'm envisioning this procurement person who's got to go, I'm in CYA mode. I got to make sure that everything has been done before, you know, I either agree to buy or I find the funds for this. Oh, here's this long list of the times of the meetings, the lengths of the meetings. I'm just imagining this checklist that you've got, that you've built with things crossed off going, okay, everything's done. Like, if all these things have happened, we must be set to go.
If we've already had, which we typically have had a lot of pricing conversations already, those are all included in there. And so they can see like, okay, we spoke to, you know, the CFO and can see all of that. And then it's just becomes much clearer of like what's left to do.
I love it. That's great. And that's really about being in charge of that process. Like you said, collaborative, but being the project manager of that sales process, which is weird because a lot of salespeople don't think of themselves that way, right? They just want to sell and talk people into it and build relationships and go to happy hours or whatever, versus managing this project. So let's shift a little bit, because one of the things that I think is fascinating, especially in this odd time that we live in, this different time with this pandemic, especially with people being remote, they can work remote, their customers are now remote and spread all over everywhere, is how do you manage, what are you finding for managing accounts, territories, the amount that somebody can handle, you know, both like maybe what would have been done pre-pandemic, what's happening now, what kind of shifts happening, and what's success look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're hearing this across the board that activity is the most critical thing to understand right now from a revenue perspective across the board. Because without having meetings and calls and emails to an account, you will never get a deal done, right? So it's super crucial for these, especially these CROs, want to understand what have their teams been doing during this pandemic if the revenue isn't being, you know, posted to the leaderboard, right? So it's something that we're super focused on at Clary in particular. This activity tracking space has really blown up and evolved over the past few years, and now in this pandemic world, even more so, because you need to benchmark what good looks like and what's possible so people don't burn out. Since we know people are working way longer hours since they're working from home, like what is that perfect blend of number of accounts, the priority of those accounts, which is definitely something you have to take into account, because different priority accounts based on whether they fit into your ideal customer profile may take more or less time. And then from that, as you're building out territories, ensuring there's, you know, equity and ensuring people who were doing a lot and meet and having a lot of meetings, but meetings with the right accounts, not just meetings for meeting's sake, meetings with high priority accounts that they're, you know, they're taken care of, and that ones who are maybe lower performing, that they're told like, hey, you're not going to get new accounts until you've met with all your high priority accounts. And so that visibility into that activity is just paramount. Every single customer, prospective customer we talk to needs and wants to know that. And I think it's also the fastest way to understand whether a deal is really going to happen, right? Like at the end of the day, if you haven't met with them in 2 weeks and you're committing this deal, like that's very concerning. And if you have no upcoming meeting booked, that's very concerning too. So a lot of ways to slice and dice that activity data, but I think across the board, it's just really important to have that data available to coach around and to also like run alongside your forecast.
So let's talk about the elephant in the room. Sometimes salespeople don't like to interact with their CRM and enter the data. So how have you found success in empowering or ensuring that the team understands the importance of that? So that you can then lead.
Yeah. So they shouldn't have to enter it manually. That's the very first thing. There's so many solutions out there, including ours, that capture that data for you. So I didn't do that before. I hated entering who I met with and creating the new contact and like, you know, oh, there was like six people in the meeting. I wasn't going to create six people. So they should not have to do that. That's number one, because that then gets the accurate data into the platform if it's captured automatically. And then I think you're kind of alluding to the next factor that everyone asks about, which is kind of the big brother perception of watching what salespeople are doing. But at the end of the day, that is what coaching around deals, that's what has to happen to coach around deals, right? Like there has to be visibility into who you're meeting with. And I think like people, old school reps, like were going to the steakhouse and playing golf, and like that meeting might not be on their calendar as much as it would be now in this like virtual world. Everything is getting booked and scheduled, and we got Calendly and all these other tools to make it easy. So yeah, I think it's evolved over the past couple of years too.
So let's take this as a short commercial break, if you will. Explain what Clary does and the value that provides, because I think it's interesting both from a, you know, if it works for companies out there, because I, you know, I love the work that you're doing. And obviously, if your company can help people, I want to give you that platform. And then also, a lot of people just don't even understand technology like this is available at all. whether it, your platform is the right for them or not, like there's an awareness thing about, wait, you're talking about, I don't have to enter stuff into a CRM.
Absolutely.
So why don't you talk about what you guys do?
Yeah. So we are a revenue operations platform that offers full funnel accountability for all go-to-market teams. So essentially we do everything from capturing that data from email and calendar to helping you forecast. And we, as part of that, we are also ensuring that you're able to get to that forecast accuracy because we bring in machine learning and we're starting to learn what your reps are doing, what deals are more likely to close, what that activity looks like. And so really it gives sales, operation, marketing, finance teams the visibility into seeing what's happening with the revenue org. So we have a bidirectional sync with Salesforce so that people, the sales reps, don't have to enter things in Salesforce. They enter it in Clary or it gets automatically entered for them. And, you know, our big vision is that revenue is really a process. It's not just an outcome, and that actually forecasting is really a lagging indicator of the rest of all the work that should have gone up to leading to those deals closing. So it really starts with the platform of trustworthy data. It goes into go-to-market insights, so being able to take that data and better coach around it. And then that sales execution piece, which is how do we create less friction for the reps so that they can actually spend their time on the relationships and not on, you know, entering what they did when, or reporting the news up to their boss. So, that's a little summary, of what we do. And our, you know, the sales technology space is really exploding right now. Revenue intelligence is something that everyone is trying to understand and get better at.
So how does it do the data entry automatically? Like, explain that piece a little bit.
Email or Outlook, for example. So we sync directly with those. It's not going into, from the activity perspective, it's not going into Salesforce. So again, like we sync with Gmail, it captures who you met with in that meeting, what the title of the meeting was, and if those contacts weren't already in your CRM, it automatically creates them because it notices it's not there yet and sales is engaged.
Got it. So it's creating that contact. I mean, you might just have an email in your calendar invite, and then what? It's going out there into the interwebs and finding them?
No. So we have a partnership with Clearbit. So it enriches the data in and gets that into CRM. So it would say, this is the person's title, this is their name. And then it would say, like, engaged with sales on X date.
Got it. I love it. And then for you specifically, because this technology is all amazing, but for you, I know you're doing enterprise level. Clary, is there an ideal size? Is there a revenue where this makes sense, you know, based on the cost? Because, you know, this kind of technology isn't necessarily cheap or easy to implement for some people. Is there a size or is it just open? You have the ability to serve everybody.
We have the ability to serve everyone. So we have 10-person sales teams using us, but we also have, you know, thousands of person sales and revenue teams using our platform. And I think we've helped a ton of companies go pre to post IPO and through that high growth period in their company life cycle, having this visibility into what's happening has been crucial. So we run the gamut.
any size. I love it. So what from that, then, that perspective, from what you're seeing from the Clary view with your customers, what are you seeing that your customer companies are doing right now? The ones who you feel are successful in navigating this landscape, making sales, increasing revenue, you know, the silver lining in these dark clouds. A lot of companies see the dark clouds. A lot of companies and people are just like, okay, let's just go anyway. What are you seeing? Is there any common themes, any traits, attributes?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the number one theme is integrated revenue operations. And what that means is you don't have marketing ops, sales ops, biz ops, integrate all that under one team. It might fall under the CIO, might fall, sometimes it even falls under the CRO or CFO, but you essentially have all of the teams that are looking at the data under one roof so that they're not operating in different systems and so that they do truly use a consolidated process and system. So that's huge. Like once people are thinking about breaking down those silos and have actually hire people to make the changes to do that, we're seeing those are the most successful companies because again, it's like, it's efficiency. It's not he said, she said. It's we're all looking at the same metrics every week. You know, we understand what pipeline needs to be generated to hit our goals. It's just really transparent. But if you have, you know, 20 Excel spreadsheets floating around that different teams are using, there's no way everyone's going to be on the same page. So, you know, we are constantly like helping show this world of breaking down silos is only beneficial for the end game and increasing your revenue.
And I love too, because there's so many things from our first conversation for the podcast that still stand in my head, which is that transparency, right? And everyone would agree that transparency, you got to be transparent. One of the big things you had touched on last time was, you know, we know that everybody's going to spin the data their own way to tell their own story. It's what we do. It's human nature, right? Sometimes it's malicious, but it's usually just people's default nature. But what I love the most that you said was, okay, there's transparency. And then it also needs to be real time so that it's just real time and there is no storytelling. There's no spinning. It's transparent and real and it's instant. And here it is. Now go.
Yeah, and that's the problem with Excel, right? It's never real time. It's even Google Sheets, they are not real time enough because someone has to enter it, right? It's not like sometimes there's data being dumped, but it's being dumped on a schedule. So it's not, you know, actually real time. And then again, it's the concept of sometimes having too many metrics means that you don't know what to coach around and what to focus on. So I think that's also something that we've seen is like almost a simplifying of what's important every week to look at in, say, a forecast or a pipeline call.
Got it. I think that's great. I mean, it can easily spin out of control with metrics if you're not careful and KPIs. And usually what I see is organizations where it expands and there's this, I don't know, I've never used this term before, but a KPI creep. And it's just this creep of KPIs, right? Like scope creep. And then all of a sudden, next thing you know, it hits this critical mass. Something happens and it comes down to like one or two KPIs. And then the cycle usually starts again. But yeah, the reset breaking point, right? You see that?
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I think it's really like, we know, I think almost all these organizations know that it's not good when teams are siloed, right? But it needs to be like an organizational change to get it to a point where they all roll into the same leadership. Once that happens, it's like magic because suddenly they're speaking the same language. They aren't like fighting for dollars. It's all their dollars. They are looking at duplication, right? Like, oh, you already have that system for that. Like we do too. We have something that does something similar. Like, why are we both spending on this? So it's really crucial to fall under one integrated revenue operations umbrella, because again, these teams historically have been just like running in their lane and not sharing their data or sharing their tool set with others.
Yeah. And the problem ends up that everybody is rowing a different direction, their own direction. And if they're not aligned, then who knows where it's going to go. And it's usually just stress and strain versus everyone rowing the same direction. And then the boat is going clearly one direction. And then it can shift as a group. So Maya, thanks for joining me. Thanks for coming back again. Thanks for, I don't know if this was your first appearance since the maternity leave ended, but either way, thank you for joining me here, freshly back in the mode.
Absolutely. No. It's my first video interview since I've been back. So yes.
Well, and it's funny because as soon as I knew you were coming back, it was like, I want to have you on, hey, talk about this and catch up. And then also that exciting news. So that's great. For people, anybody watching and listening to this, they can obviously find you on LinkedIn. So Maya, if you just search Maya Connett, they'll find you, or your whole thing is Maya Palmer Connett. They can find you there. Where else is a good place to find you? Content, value, reach out to you.
LinkedIn's kind of, I'd say, my number one source. I use Twitter sparingly, but occasionally. Look forward to connecting with folks.
Perfect. Thanks again for joining me here this morning, Maya. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the Authentic Persuasion Show. If you found value in this episode, please do two things. Subscribe so you can get each new episode, and share this episode with anyone else you know in sales. Together, we can help shift the way sales is done. And if you want to find out more information about how to transform your sales career, or you want help with shifting your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, go to jasoncutter.com. Don't forget that everything in life is sales, and I will catch you on the next episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show.